and, I admit, some anxiety. I spent a long time fretting. What did it mean? Eventually, I began wondering if something positive might develop.
Did you worry about Felice making demands? Bit said,
she assured me she wasn't interested in money. Then she said she'd been wrong to draw me in. I should forget about it.
You didn't. Bit's lips worked. What began as a frown ended as a smile.
As you've seen, I'm not always cooperative.
Mo Reed returned.
Nothing in the garage, LT.
A glance at Bit.
Like he said, literally, no car, no tools, just dust. There is a toolbox under the kitchen sink, a couple of Phillips, one wrench, a measuring tape. In terms of blades, he's got flatware for two, looks pretty flimsy, and one Henkel's knife with no visible blood, but I'll bag it.
There won't be blood. I'm a vegetarian,
said Bit. Milo said,
do it. I told Sean to drive to the lab. If he's close enough, have him come back and add the knife. There's no blood,
Bit repeated.
I promise.
Chapter 38. Moments after Reed's exit, Marlon Maroney came thundering down the stairs.
Can I talk in front of him?
Go, said Milo.
Did a second sweep. Zip.
To Bit.
That picture on the easel, you did it?
Work in progress.
You're pretty good.
I try.
Milo said,
Marlon, go next door and see how Terrell's doing.
I said, just thought of something. The son, Brett, may also be there. Maroney said,
check it out,
and made his exit. Trevor Bit.
I imagine the boy is having a tough time.
Milo said, why's that?
Chet was his father.
How'd Brett relate to you?
If we passed on the street, he'd sometimes make a face at me. I assumed Chet had told him things about me. Or maybe he's just that kind of kid.
I said, you were seen having a confrontation with Chet Corvin.
I was,
said Bit. Up the block, shortly after the body dump. Bit squinted.
Oh, that. Someone saw it.
What happened?
It was nothing.
Milo said,
tell us anyway. I'd bought Chelsea some chocolate candy. The second time. The first was for her birthday. Christmas. I told her to keep the box hidden for obvious reasons. She was careful the first time, but forgot the second time and left it on her desk. Chet browbeat her, and she told him I'd bought it. I was taking a walk, and he came after me.
Because?
He'd gotten the wrong impression. Meaning? I need to spell it out.
Milo said,
you do. He implied something inappropriate was going on. I assured him that wasn't so. I was merely helping Chelsea with her art. The chocolate was a reward for her applying herself. He told me that sounded like bullshit. She had no talent. I assured him it wasn't. He threatened me. If anything ever did happen, I'd be sorry. At that point, I said nothing. I thought he was going to hit me. My heart was tacking, beating far too rapidly. Fortunately, he left, and I tried to walk it off. We never spoke again, and Felice told me my contact with Chelsea would be reduced to when Chet was out of town for more than a day or two. She said Chelsea cried.
Milo said,
why'd you pick chocolate as a gift?
Because I like it,
said Bit.
This brand is especially high quality. I got it at a boutique in West Hollywood. One of the things that got me out of the house. She finished every piece of the first box. That's why I got her a second box.
I said, how often did your contact with Chelsea take place late at night? Bit sighed.
That. We thought she understood. but she began sneaking out, even when Chet was home. Sometimes she'd kick the side of my house. Sometimes she'd just stand around.
I said, "How'd you respond when she kicked?"
"I tried to do nothing, Doctor. Sometimes I'd hear her crying softly, and if that wasn't bad enough, I'd be worrying Chet would find her and everything would go to hell. Luckily, that never happened. But I was careful to avoid any sort of face-to-face with her when Chet was in town, to the point of not leaving in the morning until after Felice had taken the kids to school."
"You never let her in?"
"I did,"
said Bit.
"A few times. She wanted to do art, but I said we didn't have time, so we'd sit and drink tea, and then she'd return home."
Milo said,
"I'm going to call that cardiologist right now. If you've lied to me, sir, now's the time to admit it." "I haven't. Speak to the technician, 20s, African-American, strong features, especially the cheekbones. He'd be an excellent portraiture subject."
Milo took out his phone and called Maroney back.
"Everything okay?"
"Girl's still zip-tied, but she's quiet. Mother's cleaning up the kitchen, boy's upstairs. When I looked at him, he flipped me off."
"Kids," said Milo.
"Minded that, you know it would happen."
Bit hadn't followed the conversation. Eyes shut, he rested his neck on the top roll of the sofa. Within moments, his mandible had dropped, and he was snoring open-mouthed. Maroney and Milo looked at each other, then me. Interrogation 101. The guilty ones were more likely to doze. Milo pulled out his phone and walked to another room. He came back looking as if he'd drunk a punch bowl of spit. Stepping up to Bit, he stomped his foot hard. Bit roused. His eyes worked to focus.
"You're a lucky day, Mr. Bit. Courtesy cardiac tech Antonio Jenkins."
He undid Bit's cuffs. Bit said,
"We're finished?"
"Not quite," said Milo. "You're covered for the night of Chet Corvin's murder, but that doesn't mean you weren't involved in it."
"I don't understand."
"You're a man of means, Mr. Bit."
Bit squinted.
"You're saying I paid someone to kill Chet?"
"Did you?"
"Of course not. Why would I do that?"
"He scared you. He was mean to Chelsea. You wanted to help Felice be free of him."
"That's not how I deal with things,"
said Bit.
"What's your thing?"
"Retreat,"
said Trevor Bit. His fingers fluttered on his lap.
"I am, at heart, a coward."
I said, "Dogs sometimes bite out of fear."
"I've never harmed anyone or anything physically in my life. That's why I refused to hunt with my father. That's why I got pounded on in prep school."
Milo said,
"A vegetarian."
Leaving his favorite carnivore wisecrack unspoken, so was Hitler.
"Let's talk about the body left next door. Where were you that night?"
"Here."
"Doing what?"
"Drawing."
"New cartoon?"
"I don't cartoon anymore,"
said Bit.
"A sketch for a painting. A pair of parrots. Follow-up to the barrel and hummingbirds I'm working on. What that other officer saw on the easel."
"Love to see it myself."
Bit looked puzzled.
"That will verify my whereabouts?"
"Nah, but I'm into art appreciation."
Bit climbed unsteadily, gripping the banister, stopping every few steps to catch his breath. When we reached the landing, his chest heaved. If this wasn't theater, he was in no shape to transport a body and drag it across a house. Milo said,
"You okay, sir?"
"I'm fine."
Bit leaned on the banister.
"The night of the first murder, I saw something. I thought it was unimportant. It probably is. A truck drove past my studio window.
He pointed to an open door. An easel faced the front of the house, soaking in friendly southern light. Milo said,
"What time?" "Before the hubbub, maybe an hour before. Can't say for sure. The engine sound is what caught my attention. I was painting, looked outside, and saw it. At first I thought I'd been robbed."
Milo said,
"Robbed of what?" "My truck, Lieutenant. It resembled mine."
"Dodge Ram."
"I'm not saying it was the same make, just a general resemblance. About the same size and a dark color, possibly black, like mine. I went downstairs, saw that my truck was still there, and forgot about it."
Milo looked at me, both of us remembering Binchy's witness spotting a pickup leaving the neighborhood. He said,
"A murder next door, but you figured it wasn't important." "Would another apology do any good?"
said Bit, sounding dispirited.
"What time did this take place?" "Don't wear a watch," said Bit. "Don't pay attention to time. All I can tell you is well before the Corvins returned. I heard their engine, too. That SUV he drives rumbles. I saw them get out and go inside the house and went back to work. A while later, the light in my studio changed. The window was striped with color. Those bars atop your police cars are extremely color-saturated. Then those other lights on poles, people talking.
You weren't curious enough to come out and check?"
"When I saw Chelsea leave the house, the others as well, I assumed it was a burglary. The next day, Felice told me what had happened."
Milo said,
"Does Chelsea have a pal who drives a dark truck the same size as yours?"
Bit's head swung toward him.
"You can't be serious."
"We consider everything."
"Chelsea's gentle."
Milo touched the side of his eye. Bit winced.
"I don't know anything about Chelsea's friends. She's never talked about having any. But she had nothing to do with anything."
"You know that because?"
"I know my daughter."
"Would you be willing to release your financial records for inspection?"
The topic shift threw Bit. Classic detective trick. When he stopped blinking, he said,
"What kind of inspection?"
"Unusual cash withdrawals."
"For what?"
"Really, Lieutenant?"
said Bit.
"As if I'd know how to hire some kind of assassin."
"A look at your records could clear up the issue."
"Be my guest, Lieutenant, but there are no records here. Everything's handled by a trustee."
"Who's that?"
"A management firm in Palo Alto. Swartzstein Associates. They've worked with us for generations. The executive for my account is Don Swartzstein."
Milo said,
"Spell that, please."
Bit recited slowly.
"So how does it work?"
"I suppose I'll need a release. Get me a form and I'll sign it."
Milo said,
"I meant, how do you get your bills paid?"
"Swartzstein pays them. Credit card bills, utilities, taxes. For odds and ends, they send me a monthly allowance."
"How much?"
$2,000 a month."
"Tight budget,"
said Milo.
"Enough for me,"
said Bit.
"At the end of the year, I send some of it back, and Don reinvests it. That I can show you."
We followed Bit as he opened the door to a bedroom set up with a Chinese wedding bed, a Victorian dresser, three paintings on the three walls, and little else. He rifled in a drawer and handed Milo a computer printout. Year-end summary below the letterhead of the investment company. Most of the activity co-managed by the Palo Alto office of Chase Private Client. Current balance in an extraneous expenses account, $12,356.13. Monthly deposits of $2,000 on the third of each month, slightly over half making a return trip. Bit said,
"My needs are simple. I use it for food and art supplies."
I said, "Speaking of art," and headed for the studio. Not one easel, a pair. The second positioned against a windowless section of the western wall, invisible from the doorway. The one facing the street propped a painting of two luminous, beautifully rendered emerald-breasted birds hovering in midair. The other displayed a canvas the same size, filled with muddy blotches. Bit pulled a sketch pad out of a flat file and showed us a pencil sketch of two macaws.
What I was working on that night.
I said, "Why don't you cartoon anymore?" Bit said,
"I came to see it for what it was. Mean-spirited, seize on deformity and magnify. I had enough."
He pointed to Chelsea's painting.
"Interesting, no? Bringing order to chaos. To me, this paler section up here represents dawning clarity."
That sounded like art-speak BS. I saw blotches. Love knows no bounds. Bit took our silence as debate.
"It's conceptual," he insisted.
"She's the only thing I've ever really conceived."
Chapter 39. We left Bit in his studio and convened on the sidewalk. Afternoon was conceding to evening, trees zebra-striping sidewalks, a mustard glow limning rooftops. Milo said,
"Please tell me you don't agree."
"About what?"
"Bit's clean."
I said, "Cardiac tech verified his alibi?"
"Belted and hooked up for 8 hours. Never left the sleep lab."
The door to Bit's house opened, and the artist stuck his head out.
"I just got off the phone with Don Schwartzstein. No form necessary. Call him at your convenience."
Milo said,
"My new pal. Damn it."
"Your level of charm, you're surprised?" Another door opened a few houses down. Another head, peering out briefly, then withdrawing. Suburban whack-a-mole. A brief phone chat with Donald Schwartzstein III left Milo shaking his head as he pocketed his cell.
"Guy has that tood you get from people who live off the rich."
I said, "Thinks he's more than a babysitter."
"You must be a psychologist." "Yeah, he's a stick-up-the-ass snoot. He also backs up Bit's claim that there's no other money."
We entered the Corvin house. Marlon Maroney stood watch on the upstairs landing. He came down looking bored.
"Girl's in her bedroom doing whack drawings. I figured it was okay. She gets ideas about her fucking pencil. I can handle it."
I said, "Whack as in?"
"Hope you don't want me to get medical, Doc. Whack as in tiny little squares over and over. But what do I know about art? She's also got headphones on, attached to a, get this, CD player. Country Joe and the Fish. My older brother was into all that flower power crap."
I said, "San Francisco, her father's era." Maroney said,
"You cleared him?"
"Disgustingly alibied," said Milo. "What about the boy and Mrs. C?"
"He's in his room playing video games. She's at the kitchen table pretending nothing happened. I got a look at her screen, something about curriculum.
She works for the school district."
"Figures. She's got that mean teacher vibe. Anything else you need?"
Milo said, "Nah, you can go. Thanks, Marlon."
"Thank you for the overtime," said Maroney.
He checked a rubber-strapped diver's watch.
"Shift's not officially over, but I'm assuming we're not going to get all fractional."
Milo said,
"I'll put it in as a full. Enjoy life."
Maroney rolled his shoulders and put on mirrored shades.
"This one chalks up as a good day. Had nothing to do in the first place, and I'm walking away healthy."
Felice Corvin sat typing at the kitchen table. She saw us, but kept working. Milo said,
"Let's talk about Chelsea."
Felice's fingers rested on the keys. Her eyes faced her screen.
"Hasn't there been enough stress for one day?"
"Not as much as there could have been, ma'am, as in I don't need a white cane."
"That was unfortunate."
"Fortunate for me, ma'am."
"Of course. I'm sorry. Chelsea's sorry."
"She can atone by cooperating."
"She has nothing to offer, Lieutenant."
"I won't know that until I talk to her."
"I'm her mother. Trust me."
Milo said nothing. Felice shut her laptop.
"She's a minor."
"She comes of age in a few days."
"Rules are rules."
That sounded like something she was used to saying.
"I have no problem with rules," said Milo. "The penal code's got one about attempted assault on a police officer."
"Oh, please, she didn't even touch you."
"Not for lack of trying, Miss Corvin. She can be arrested right now for a serious felony. I'm assuming you'd rather I talk to her."
"This is extortion."
"No, ma'am. Extortion is a crime, and I'm not a criminal. I'm laying out contingencies."
She didn't answer. He said,
"Have it your way."
Reaching around under his jacket, he produced his cuffs. Felice shot to her feet.
"Please!"
Milo looked her in the eye. She made a fist, but uncurled it quickly.
"You're wasting your time. But fine, let's go talk to her. You'll see she has nothing to say."
"Sorry, no."
She squinted.
"No what?"
"I talk to her. You stay here."
"You're not allowed. She's a minor."
"I'm allowed if you say so."
His fingertip began a slow climb toward his eye.
"Stop that. I get the point."
Milo smiled.
"Interesting choice of words."
Felice Corvin gritted her teeth.
"You're being vindictive."
"I'm working 2 murder investigations."
"That Chelsea knows nothing about."
"I hope you're right."
She crossed her arms.
"I don't see why I can't be with her."
"I want to talk to her when she's not being influenced."
"That's absolutely moronic."
"You're entitled to your opinion, ma'am. If you prefer, Chelsea can be taken in, booked, and put in a holding cell. You'll hire an expensive lawyer who'll get her bail and block access to her. But the process will continue, and that means indictment and either a deal or trial."
"This is Orwellian. How can you go along with this, Dr. Delaware, a so-called healthcare professional?"
I said, "No one's out to harm Chelsea. We realize raising her has been a challenge."
"Oh, you have no idea."
"Now that she knows who her father is, new challenges will come up. The quicker she can be eliminated from the investigation, the better." Her chest rose and fell.
"You'll guarantee her emotional well-being?"
"No one can guarantee anything. I can assure you that she'll be treated with sensitivity."
"Then why can't I be there?"
"Because it's important that Chelsea be treated as an individual."
"Oh, sure, it's for her own good."
"It might be," I said. "When's the last time she was taken seriously?" Her cheeks reddened.
"You have no right to say that. She's always..."
"Fine. Do whatever useless thing you think you need to do. But I'm holding you responsible, both of you. I'm also going with you to the stairs and staying there. If I hear anything the least bit inappropriate, I'm going to step in." Milo said,
"Fine with me."
He beckoned her toward the doorway with an arm flourish. She sat there, waved dismissively.
"Oh, forget it. I'll stay here. The onus is on you."
As we crossed the dining room, Milo whispered,
"You disapprove of my methods?"
I said, "She did try to blind you." He grinned.
friend in need.
Chapter 40. When we reached the stairs, he said,
"How about you take this?"
"What do you want me to concentrate on?"
"Friends, social life, the Camaro, her love life. Hell, anything she wants to say. Not that I'm hoping for much."
"I'm the court of last resort, huh?"
"That's why you get the big bucks."
Chelsea Corvin hunched at her desk, headphones mussing her hair. She'd filled a quarter of the sheet with precise rows of raisin-sized ovals. A tongue tip protruded between her lips. Milo stood back. I stepped in front of the girl, ensuring I was visible. She shifted her grip on the pencil, holding it in a curled fist like a toddler. I stood there. Her line broke, and she switched back to an adult grip and kept working. Like mother... Keeping my eye on the graphite point, I removed the headphones. No reaction. "Hi, Chelsea. I'd like to talk to you." She shifted her hand, embarked on a new row of ovals. Stub-nailed, grubby fingers tightened around the pencil. "Chelsea?"
"About what?"
"First of all, I want to let you know Trevor's fine."
"Dad."
"Dad's fine." The pencil point hovered above the desk. I pulled up a chair beside her. "Finding out he's your dad is a big change."
"Uh-uh."
"It isn't a big change?"
"No."
She finished the row. "Chelsea, is there anything you can tell us about the man left in your house?"
"The dead guy,"
she said.
"Uh-uh."
"What about what happened to, what should I call, Chet?" Silence. New row. "Should we call him Chet, Mr. Corvin?" A smirk stretched her lips.
"Used to be Dad."
"Used to be Dad it is." She gave a start, muttered under her breath. I said, "Pardon?"
She half-turned.
Hot black eyes, cigarette holes on paper.
"He never liked me."
"Never?"
"He liked Brett."
"Any idea who killed him?"
"Someone he got mad."
"Like who?" She looked at me again.
"Someone he got mad. That's probably why the dead guy was in his room."
"You think used to be Dad was targeted?"
"He got them mad."
"Them," I said.
"Anyone."
Shrug.
"Whatever."
"No idea who that might be?"
"He's not my dad," she said.
"I know. So who might have targeted him?"
"He's not my dad."
Whining.
"How can I know?"
Irritation, then indifference. But no tension, no tells. I waited out two more rows. "Chelsea, do you know anyone who drives a Camaro?"
"Nope."
"A black Camaro?"
"Nope."
"None of your friends drives a black Camaro?"
"I don't got friends."
Matter of fact, no visible regret. Milo's phone beeped a text. She looked back at him, said,
"Sorry. For before."
"No prob, kid."
He read the message and frowned. I said, "No one you know drives a Camaro."
"No."
"Dad drives a pickup."
"Uh-uh, a Range Rover."
"I meant Trevor." She turned scarlet. Her hand faltered.
"Yeah."
I said, "Do you know anyone who drives a truck like Dad's?"
"Him."
Hooking a thumb to the left.
"Him?"
"Him,"
she said. "Who's that, Chelsea?" Another leftward jab. "I don't get it, Chelsea."
"Him. In that house."
I said,
Mr. Wayland drives a truck like that? I saw him in a Taurus.
He got a car and a truck.
Mr. and Mrs. Wayland?
Yeah.
What color is it?
Gray.
Dark or light?
Dark.
Another row completed, she smoothed the paper with her hands, judged herself, and scowled.
Anything else you want to tell me, Chelsea?
Two deep breaths before she put her pencil down. She twisted clumsily in her chair and faced Milo.
Sorry. Really.
He said, "Forget it, kiddo. No big deal." She mouthed, "Kiddo." Smiled. Turned grave.
Sorry. Really, really.
It's really no prob, Chelsea. Just be careful in the future.
You won't put me in jail?
Not a chance.
Mom said...
The girl shuddered. Mom told you I was gonna put you in jail?
If I don't shape up soon, I'm in for trouble.
Tears pooled in her eyes.
I don't do that.
Do what?
Hurt people.
Like father. Her hands fluttered. Opening a desk drawer, she took out a sheet and held it out to him. Rows of diamonds.
For you.
Original art? Thanks, kiddo. Though I'm really not supposed to take gifts on the job.
Mom could mail it to you?
Milo said, "No need, Chelsea. This'll be fine." She hung her head, placed her palms on her cheeks. Some of the flush had faded, leaving her skin with a mottle of raspberry swirl ice cream. I said, "We're going to leave now. If you think of anything you want to tell us, Lieutenant Sturgis will give you his card." Three immediate staccato nods. Mechanical movements, as if an unseen puppeteer was manipulating her head. Milo handed her the card. She studied it.
Rectangle. I'm gonna draw rectangles.
Chapter 41. Milo looked relieved to step outside. The sun was gone, mustard rooftops deepened to smoky brown. Backyard chatter updrafted from somewhere. Someone was grilling meat. I said, "Who texted you?"
Sean took it upon himself to recheck Chelsea's social media. Still nothing.
I said, with a secret boyfriend, she'd have reason to avoid social media. But when I brought up the Camaro, she didn't blink, and this isn't a glib girl. Reaching into his pocket, he unfolded the page of diamonds.
Why does she do this?
No idea.
Take a guess.
Maybe striving for order? Or it's all she can do. He took another look before refolding the paper and slipping it back into his pocket.
I've seen worse in galleries.
I said, put it in your investment portfolio. One day she might be famous.
A truck, he said. One of the Waylands. There goes another lead.
Has to be Donna. When we were with Paul, the Taurus was in the driveway.
Makes sense. They're Splitsville. She packed her stuff in the bed and left.
He told us she was visiting her mother. I can see him not wanting to get into his marital problems. But at the time, I got a clear sense she'd been away for a while, not a few hours. He rubbed his face.
Where are you going with this?
Probably nowhere, I said. But it might not hurt to take a closer look at the neighbors on the other side.
What, Donna didn't take the truck? Paul did? Then he stashed it somewhere, swapped for the Taurus, and got back in time to play benevolent neighbor? Why?
Like I said, it's likely nothing. On the other hand, a pickup would be great for transporting a body. The return trip, perfect for ditching a shotgun and a bloody tarp. If you knew the cops would be at your house, you'd want to be careful. He rubbed his face.
Waylon's a homicidal maniac? You're giving me mental whiplash, amigo.
We've been focusing on Bit because everyone pointed us in his direction, including Wayland.
That's because everyone knows Bit's weird.
Sure, but step away from that, and the same factors making Bit a suspect could be applied to Wayland. He could know the Corvins didn't set their alarm. He'd be familiar with the layout of the Corvin house. In fact, he'd have an easier time than Bit transporting a body to the Corvins because his property abuts their garden gate. Both of us turned toward the pseudo-hacienda. Empty driveway, lights off. Milo said,
"Paul, the mild-mannered blood fiend?"
Like I said, probably
nothing, yeah, yeah.
What would be Wayland's motive,
and how does Braun figure in?
I've got no explanation for Braun, I said, but the motive could be classic. Jealousy. What if Donna left Paul because she was one of Chet Corvin's on the sides? On top of that, Chet was derisive toward Wayland. Even when Wayland had taken his, he lorded his finances over the guy. You rent, I own. Sexual jealousy plus long simmering resentment? We could be talking a combustible mixture.
Chet and Donna, he said. If she's screwing Chet, you're right. She's only one of his honeys. That picture we found isn't the brunette he bought the necklace for and shacked up with in the Arrowhead love nest, which still hasn't been processed by San Badu. Some twit named Livingston seems to enjoy shining me on.
I said, hair color's easy to change, and pounds can be taken off. Interviewing Donna could clear it up, but in all this time we've never laid eyes on her. What if she was scared of Paul and was hiding out at the Arrowhead house, moving to hotels with Chet for security? Maybe the two of them decided to make the break and run off together, beginning with a bon voyage at the Sahara, kicked up with wine, lingerie, and dirty movies. What if Wayland stalked Donna to the motel, got in with a ruse, executed Chet, and abducted her at gunpoint?
In Chet's Rover? Wayland's already got two vehicles that he supposedly shuffles like cards. Why add a third?
If he used his own wheels and someone copied the plates, he'd be toast. There could also be symbolic value to using the Rover. I'm retrieving what's mine and taking your fancy wheels.
So where's the Rover now?
If he stashed the truck or the Taurus a few minutes away, he could have driven over and swapped it. My guess would be a dark side street, so he could transfer his captive without being spotted. If he left the Rover unlocked with the keys in the ignition, how long would it last in East Hollywood?
On its way to El Salvador.
Jamming his hands in his pockets, he walked away from me, paced 30 steps, walked past me, and did another 20. He returned and looked up and down the block.
Oh, man, the way your gray cells pop.
I said, Chet and Donna isn't that far-fetched. Take away online hookups, and how do affairs begin? At work, or between friends and neighbors? Not that I've got evidence, but...
Neither do I, after 22 days. But who's counting? Shit.
He beelined to the Wayland house, where he stopped in the driveway and glanced at the Corvins' garden gate. I caught up as he continued to the Wayland's front courtyard. No mail piled up at the door. The view through the front windows was unfettered and unremarkable. The same bland space the Corvins had used for sanctuary, while a corpse moldered next door. Milo said,
"Hopefully old Paul's doing his school district thing, and I can pay him a visit soon. Meanwhile, let's learn more about him and his missing missus."
We sat in the unmarked, where he scanned the recovered vehicle list. Still nothing on Chet Corvin's Range Rover. Passcoding onto DMV revealed no registrations under Paul Wayland's name, but Donna Wayland was the owner of a 4-year-old silver Taurus and a 3-year-old gray Ford Ranger pickup. Milo copied down the VINs and the tags, moved on to the criminal databases. Both Waylands appeared to be solid citizens. I said, "Okay, so it's an air sandwich, though I do find it interesting that the cars are in her name. Maybe he has credit problems. If she controls the money, there's another layer of resentment. He tapped the steering wheel.
You know, I take what you come up with seriously, but there's a problem with the stash-the-evidence theory. Wayland couldn't go too far because he had to be back in time to play Mr. Helpful with the Corvins. Making it to PCH and back might be possible, but finding a rural dump spot in Malibu would be a serious drive. No way.
I thought about that. Are there any storage units nearby? In the best of all worlds, one with ample tenant parking and CCTV?
He said, I'll have Sean check, but first I need to keep Petra in the loop.
He tried her numbers, got no answer. The same for Raoul Biro. Both Hollywood D's were sent a long text catching them up and asking them to re-examine video footage for evidence of either Wayland vehicle on the night of Chet Corvin's murder. No return texts.
Can't begrudge them private lives, he said,
sounding as if he might one day believe that. Sean Binchy was still at the station, a man without any apparent circadian rhythms, and cheerful as always. Milo asked him to look for storage units near the Corvin house.
Got it, Loot. Also, put bolos out on the Wayland's vehicles. Here's the info.
Binchy copied.
Something come up on them?
Not yet, Sean, but maybe it's not a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
All that nice real estate. Go no, Loot.
Huh?
Glad you called. I was just about to try you. The desk left me a message slip for you. Someone named Henry Prieto. Want me to follow up?
No, I'll handle it. Thanks, Sean.
Hey, I love my job.
Prieto residence. Lieutenant Sturgis, sir. Got a message. 3 hours ago you got it, said Prieto. Right after I saw that black Camaro driving up and down my street in a suspicious manner. It made two circuits, parked in front of her place, Maria Braun's. Driver proceeded to exit, continued toward her front door, observed me observing him, and ran off like a scared bunny. Male Caucasian, 19 to early 20s, 5'11", thin build, 140 to 50, stringy blonde hippie hair to his shoulders, acne pimples on his face. Too far away to ascertain eye color. I wrote down the plate. Tags are not current. Blue could be 14-09-04, etc., depending on how far back you want to go.
You're a gem, Sergeant.
Doing my job. Got a pencil?
Back to DMV with the Camaro's plates. As expected, no match to currently registered vehicles, but fees had been paid in 2009. Milo took the time to put out this bolo, listing the car as stolen, before sending another text to Petra, adding another CCTV target. Onward to the Camaro's last owner of record, Edda May Halverson, the 1200 block of Laguna Street, Santa Barbara, California. I said, Hal Braun went up to Santa Barbara and came back fired up about something. Milo looked up Edda Halverson. 91 years old, 5'4", 160, white and blue. Corrective lenses required. No license for 5 years. I said, she can't drive anymore, so her grandson, or great-grandson, gets the car, but lets the reg lapse. Or he's just someone who bought it from her, and she can give you a name.
Let's find out, he said, if she's still breathing.
If a current landline was evidence of life, Edda Halverson was inhaling and exhaling. The number was unlisted and took a while to get. Milo finally getting help from a Santa Barbara detective he'd worked with before named Braxton, who scoped utility records. Milo thanked her and made the call. No pickup, no voicemail. He logged back to NCIC.
91, he said. This'll be a waste of time unless she's Ma Barker.
Yep, pure as milk.
Okay, let's try the Camaro kid. Maybe he's a Halverson, too, and naughty to boot.
Several men with that surname had run afoul of the criminal justice system,
but none came close to matching the skinny blonde youth Henry Prieto had seen. I said, whoever he is, he's linked to Braun and Arrowhead, meaning he might know about Chet and Donna.
Arrowhead, he said. Let's see if I can make someone guilty enough to get off his ass.
His notepad gave up the number of San Bernardino detective Roger Livingston. Off shift, but Milo pulled rank with the desk, making no mention he was L.A., not local, and got a personal cell number. Livingston picked up, sounding confused by Milo's name. Milo began to explain.
Oh, yeah, that,
Livingston said, sounding as if he was sitting on a monumental hemorrhoid.
You needed to call me at home? I'm working two homicides. Some kind of schedule would help. Yeah, well, don't count your chickens. We're short-staffed. Get shootings on a regular basis, not like Beverly Hills. I'm West L.A. Whatever, said Livingston. It's serious here. Like yesterday, we picked up a 187 in need of buku tech attention. Torched vehicle, victim in the driver's seat with a bullet hole in his head. We're still trying to ID him.
Milo said, where'd it happen?
Coming down from Arrowhead into the city, said Livingston. Gully off 18. Tight curves in the road. We get go-overs all the time. But this wasn't no accident. Gasoline used as an accelerant. Plates removed, VIN number filed off. Obviously a drug gang thing. Some of those weekenders are scumbags. By any chance, are we talking about a Taurus or a Ford Ranger? Nah, a lot more painful, said Livingston. Hot Wheels gone to waste. One of those Range Rovers.
Milo clamped his hand atop his head and worked to keep his voice even.
A Rover could be related to my cases. Put money on it, in fact.
Long silence from Livingston. Other voices drifted into the background. Kids. Livingston said,
hold on,
and moved somewhere quieter.
What the hell? One of my Vicks, the owner of the house I asked you to process, drove a Range Rover. The guy who shot him took it, along with a female hostage. A female, said Livingston. Well, our Vic's a man. Despite being barbecued, you could see a few beard hairs, long ones. And a leather hat that looks like grilled steak. Now, I gotta go take care of my kids. Guess what, Roger? I might be able to ID your Vic. What? The caretaker at the house I asked you to process had a beard and wore a leather hat. Name's David Brassing. You're shitting me, said Livingston. Where in the head was the wound? Temple. Which side?
A beat.
Left, I think. So the killer either fired from outside the car, or your Vic was in the passenger seat while it was parked. Shooter got out and lit up and staged the pushover. Anything's always possible, said Livingston. David Brassing, said Milo. If you want, I can call his house, find out if he's been missing. Then again, it's your case, Roger. Shit, said Livingston. Hold on, I need to write all this down.
He went offline for a minute.
Okay, got a pen. Let's have everyone's names.
Milo read off the list. Chet Corvin, Paul Wayland, Donna Wayland, David Brassing.
Got all that, Roger? Yeah. Shit, my Lou's gonna love this. Not. Who's that? Lieutenant Ahern. Give me his number.
Wouldn't do that if I were you, said Livingston. He don't like being called unless it's an emergency.
Three related homicides in two jurisdictions, said Milo. That's kind of emergent, Roger.
Two beats.
Okay, here it is, but don't blame me.
Chapter 42. Despite Livingston's warning, Detective Lieutenant Alan Ahern took the call calmly and graciously. No kids in the background, just jazz. Something syncopated, a Latin beat. He and Milo agreed on a first-name basis. Milo's posture loosened, someone he could communicate with. He gave Ahern a summary, repeated Livingston's assessment of a drug hit. Ahern said,
"Roger said that, huh? Caretaker at the house. Can you hold for a sec, see if we've got anything on him?"
"Sure."
Ahern was gone briefly. When he returned, no more music.
"Brassing has a record with us, but small time and not recent. I doubt this was a big drug thing. More important, his wife filed a missing on him when he didn't come home 2 days ago, which fits the initial pathology on the rover. What's your theory? He went over to check out the house, got unlucky, and surprised someone?"
"Exactly, Al," said Milo. "How far is the dump site from the house?"
"Not terribly close," said Ahern. 3-4 miles.
"But walkable if you're in shape."
"Your guy Wayland a fitness type?"
"Don't know."
"You like him for brassing because..."
"I've got zero evidence, Al, but his truck was seen driving away from the scene of my first murder. His wife could have been fooling with my second victim, and she hasn't been seen in a while. It's possible she was hiding out in the A-frame when she wasn't meeting up with Corvin in those hotels. We're wondering if Wayland found out but waited to make his move until she shacked up with Corvin in Hollywood. Probably because a hit at a motel with direct door access to each room was a hell of a lot easier than prowling the halls at some Hilton or making noise up in Arrowhead."
Ahern said, "He offs the competition, takes his lady back. But why would he return here and off brassing?"
Milo said,
"Good question. All I've got are questions."
"Know about that, Milo."
I held up a finger.
"Hold on for a sec, Al."
Milo listened to me and returned to Ahern.
"If sexual jealousy's the main motive, returning to the A-frame could be symbolic, Al. He wants to have his way with her in the same place she cheated on him."
"Symbolic? Who was that?"
"Consulting psychologist."
"You got one of those? Man, we've been trying to get funding for 2 years. All we have are counselors for when officers get PTSD. I'd ask you if it's worth it, but he's sitting right there."
Milo smiled.
"It's worth it."
"Good to know," said Ahern. "Okay, what about the kid in the Camaro?"
"Still a total blank, Al. But he's linked to my first victim, and Brassing saw him in your neck of the woods.
And now Brassing's dead. Maybe the kid's the bad guy."
"He's involved somehow," said Milo. "The plan before I heard about Brassing was to head up tomorrow to Santa Barbara, talk to the woman who last registered the car."
"No reason to change that. We'll take care of here," said Ahern. "Let me know what you learn, and I'll do the same. First thing tomorrow, one of my D's will talk to Brassing's wife and find out who his dentist is. If he didn't take care of his teeth, we'll go the DNA route, but there's about a month turnaround. I'll also schedule drive-bys of the A-frame and have my guys looking out for both of Wayland's cars and the Camaro. And the place will get processed."
"Appreciate it, but be careful," said Milo. "For all we know, Wayland's holed up there with her. The way the street's laid out, it's hard to conceal approach."
"Know it well. Used to patrol there," said Ahern. "Yeah, good advice. Okay, good talking to you, and sorry for the delay."
"No need to apologize," said Milo. "Livingston says you're swamped."
"Roger," said Ahern. "He's always swamped. Don't ask."
We got out of the unmarked and walked to the Seville.
"Poor Brassing," he said. "First I nearly shoot him, then someone does. What's your take on the Camaro kid now? Aiding and abetting Wayland or a baby-faced contract killer?"
I shook my head. He said,
"That's also my level of insight. You up for a nice coastal drive tomorrow?"
Before I could answer, his cell played Debussy. He looked at the screen, clicked on.
"What's up, Sean?"
"A whole bunch of storage places in Santa Monica and West L.A., Lute, but only one in the Palisades, and it's small. Off Sunset, north of that village shopping area. Google says it's 15 minutes from the Corvins in moderate traffic.
On a Sunday night, a hop and a jump. Go over and talk to them.
Can't right now. It's one of those DIY setups at night. Let yourself in with a card key, no staff. I can do a drive-by, see if they have cameras, and let you know. Or wait until tomorrow when someone will be there.
Go home and get some rest, kid.
I'm not tired, Loot.
Let's keep it that way.
Chapter 43 L.A. to Santa Barbara can be a gorgeous 90-mile cruise along the Pacific, or a gray-air freeway slog for two-thirds of the distance, finally graced by glimpses of water on the northern outskirts of Ventura. The last time Milo and I had made the trip was all business, the worst kind. He picked me up at 9:30, said, "I lied about scenic." Sped north on the Glen, crossed Mulholland, and dipped into the valley before picking up the freeway at Van Nuys and Riverside. Chrome soup until we got past Canoga Park and the traffic demons stopped snarling. At 11:45, we were exiting at the odd left-hand Cabrillo exit, turning right on State Street and GPSing toward the top end of the shopping district. Edda Halverson Street was a western offshoot filled mostly with small pre-war houses, some cute, others tatty, plus a few unseemly, obese, newer additions. The district had begun as solid working class, housing the people who serviced the mansions of Montecito. Now, except for retirees who'd managed to hold on due to Proposition 13 tax relief, out of reach of anyone with a blue collar. The house we were looking for was a mint-green, wood-sided bungalow. A full-length porch trimmed with lattice and millwork was painted white. Birds of paradise and yucca filled a skinny, trench-like bed of dirt paralleling the front. A brown Kia in the driveway bore a Waikiki, it's a kick, bumper sticker. The tags were current, the rear seat covered by a knitted afghan. A metal ramp was propped atop a four-step concrete stairway. Not enough room on either side to use the steps. Milo and I made the climb. A screen door, framed with the same white gimcrack, was unlocked. The solid door behind it was paneled and equipped with a brass knocker shaped like a sperm whale. Milo said, "Thar she blows," lifted and lowered. A pretty young Filipina in pink sweats opened the door. A sheet of black hair hung past her waist. Milo's badge furrowed her forehead. He said, "Nothing's wrong. We're here to talk to Miss Halverson."
"I don't think so,"
she said, but she stepped aside. The front room was as tiny and dim as MJ Braun's. The air was filled with rose-based perfume, and crowded by tables and stands hosting porcelain, ruby glass, and miniature teacups on miniature lace doilies. An upright oak piano sat along the right-hand wall. Sheet music on the rack. Porgy and Bess. Unlike the Braun House, no wide swaths set aside for handicapped access, but space at the rear provided room for a white-haired woman in a wheelchair. She was covered to the waist by a pink quilt, legs propped on rests. A jade-colored sateen robe was buttoned to the neck. Baby blue polish on her nails. The snowy hair was earlobe length, combed, waved, clasped on one side with a bakelite barrette. She smiled at us. Milo smiled back and showed her his card. Her eyes were an interesting mix of brown with blue rims. No change in focus as they stared straight ahead. The young woman said,
"She can't hear or talk, sirs."
I said, "Stroke?"
"Yes, sir."
"Recently?"
"This one? A year ago, sir."
I said, "Not the first."
"The first was 2 years ago, sir. She needed a walker, but was okay."
You've been with her all that time, miss?
Vivian. Yes, sir.
Milo.